Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Today I've got quite a hell of a story to tell you, and this story has got a lot of useful concepts in it which can help people. So let's first take a look at the background of where this story comes from. The story is going to be about a battle. Not a huge battle, but a battalion level fight that takes place on the Eastern Front in World War II. So if you look at the screen in front of you, then the man on the far left, that man, his name is Erhard Raus. Now Erhard Raus is an Austrian German. He is one of the few Austrians who reached the rank of general in World War II. And of course, then there's the Führer, Hitler. He's the commander-in-chief, and he is an Austrian German. But in the Wehrmacht, there weren't many Austrians who became generals, but Raus is one of them. In the photograph to the right of the photo of Raus is another photo that I got off another website, where they marked Raus and Manstein. So you can see Raus on the left there and von Manstein on the right. Now the history of these two is quite interesting. Raus ends up commanding a panzer division on the Eastern Front, but a lot of the time his panzer division actually falls under the command of General von Manstein. Von Manstein later becomes a field marshal, which is the highest rank you can get in an army. And Manstein and Raus are often working together. So Manstein is his commanding officer, but there are many, many things that these two get up to where Raus plays an important role. For example, at the time when Manstein comes up with the idea to go and save the 6th Army at Stalingrad, Raus, as can be expected, plays a very important role in there, with him and his panzer division fighting like crazy. I'm going to add some other stuff because I've been trying to understand Frederick the Great a lot more. King Frederick the Great was Hitler's greatest hero. If there was anybody that Hitler wanted to emulate, it was Frederick the Great. And while I was digging around trying to find something decent in English on Frederick the Great, and I must tell you, in English there is so little that is decent, but eventually I managed to actually find things that I could read that actually were really intellectual and really good. One thing that I never knew was that King Frederick the Great was actually a guy who wrote a lot. He actually wrote volumes and volumes of stuff about the wars he fought and about various things that he was thinking. He wrote mostly military stuff, and he also wrote what you could call almost manuals for his generals, because he's the King of Prussia and he actually creates the Prussian army. Now when you see a guy like Manstein, Manstein is himself, I think, a Prussian. And Prussia was basically the beginning of Germany. If you go from the time of Frederick the Great until Germany eventually comes together under Bismarck as a brand new Central European country, then you'll see that it's all done by the Prussians. Jews hate Prussia And after World War II, Prussia was totally removed from the map. They removed its borders. Germany was not allowed to have a state inside it called Prussia. Prussia was removed. They hate Prussia totally. But that's par for the course for the Jewish scum. But lots of the German officers and the German officer corps was Prussian. And of course, they were merely carrying on with the legacy of King Frederick the Great. And can you believe, while I was reading some of Manstein's memoirs, there was a point where I read about von Manstein talking about how do you defend across a river? When you are dealing with military stuff, you will find that geography plays a massive role in all military stuff. Anyway, Manstein went and wrote about defending from behind a river, but then he started saying that few people ever considered defending in front of a river. And that was the first time I'd ever heard of that in my life. Anyway, later when I was reading the military writings of King Frederick the Great, he was talking about defending behind a river versus defending in front of a river. And it actually was one of the most fascinating lines of thinking I'd ever come across, ever. But what is interesting is that clearly Manstein must have been reading Frederick the Great's military writings, because I can tell you that in all the military stuff I've ever read, I've never, ever, 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 ever come across anybody talking about defending a river from the front rather than the back. And I'm not going to go into that here. It's actually quite a fascinating, strange line of thinking. But it shows that Manstein was clearly reading and appreciating what Frederick the Great had written more than 200 years ago. And Frederick the Great died just shortly before Napoleon rose to power. So Frederick the Great and Napoleon almost lived at the same time. They were just a couple of decades apart. Now, something else that Frederick the Great wrote about was Frederick the Great wrote about the Austrians, because Frederick the Great fought the Russians, the French, and the Austrians. And the Austrians were the ones he fought against the most. And at that point in time, you had the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Frederick the Great actually writes about what good soldiers the Austrians are. And he gives examples, and he points out that the Germans, let's call it the Prussians, have to be really careful, because these Austrians are damn good fighters. The Austrians are very experienced, and you can't easily catch these Austrians out. These Austrians are not to be toyed with. You try your luck at smacking Austrians, and those Austrians are very sharp, they're very experienced, and they will kick your ass. Interestingly enough, if I may add this just of my own accord in here, I must tell you, in this modern day and age, I am quite horrified when I see how weak the Swedes are, because the Swedes also come up. Frederick the Great actually wrote a whole bunch of stuff about Charles the 12th of Sweden. Now, Charles the 12th was a very wild guy, and he was actually the first, let's call it, Western European to invade Russia. Anyhow, Frederick the Great had much to write about him. He wasn't so enchanted with Charles the 12th. And Charles the 12th might also have been a German. I've heard it said that Charles the 12th was of German descent, but he was the king of Sweden. But I must tell you, I'm amazed that the Swedes are so liberal and crazy these days. Because if you look into their history, the Swedes are another bunch of Europeans who are one bunch of kick-ass clever fighters. It's not just these Austrians that are clever fighters. The Swedes are actually amazing fighters as well. I just cannot even wrap my mind around it to believe that Swedes are liberals these days. There's no ways in hell they should be. And the Swedes, right up to the present time, they build some amazing weaponry. There's some incredible stuff that comes out of Sweden right now. Not just their Gripen fighters, but also their Bofors guns. They have built some really good stuff. The Swedes are no slouches, I must tell you. How it was that they came to become a bunch of peaceniks and worse still liberals listening to Jews and bringing non-whites into their country, I just don't know how the hell that happened, because there's no ways that makes any sense. But anyway, returning to Rouse, Gerhard Rouse actually wrote a book, a very fascinating book, and if anyone's truly interested in it, I could easily do an audiobook of it. But he wrote a very fascinating book after World War II about the stranger aspects of fighting on the Eastern Front, where he went and he wrote about weird things and strange things that happened on the Eastern Front when the Wehrmacht was fighting all these Soviets, or as the Wehrmacht referred to them, Jewish Bolshevism. So Rouse wrote about all kinds of things that happened, all kinds of battles, all kinds of incidents, all kinds of things that the Russians did, or that the Germans did. And I must tell you, it is one of the most fascinating military books I've ever read. There are things in there that I've wanted to find out about and never ever come across proper detailed writings about certain things. Like Rouse, for example, wrote about armored trains. Armored trains have fascinated me for a long time. They even used armored trains here in South Africa when the British were fighting the Boers. But the stuff that Rouse has to tell you about armored trains just blew my mind. And that's just one topic. There were lots of topics. And some of the things that the Russians and the Germans got up to on the Eastern Front, well, there are things that the Russians did that I just couldn't believe. I've always known that the war on the Eastern Front is the greatest war in the history of the world. The greatest war in the history of the world is Operation Barbarossa, the fight between Germany and Russia. And if only it wasn't for the totally idiotic, evil Americans and the British who were helping the Russians, the Germans would have won the greatest victory in the history of the European people. There is no question that the Wehrmacht would have won the greatest victory of all time. And Hitler would have had his chance to be Frederick the Great. He would have had his chance to be as wonderful as his hero. But as time has gone by, I've always known that this war was the greatest war, and I've known about the major battles, and I've looked at this and that, but I've never really delved into deeper stuff, all kinds of detail that comes from soldiers and generals about specific other things that were going on there. But I must tell you, as time goes by, I've started looking a little bit here and there, just out of pure interest, not because it particularly has any relevance to racial stuff, but I must tell you, there's some really interesting things I've come across that relate to the Eastern Front. And you're about to hear one of them. And the fighting that took place there and the kinds of things that the Russians got up to is really quite something else. And then when you see how the Germans have to respond and deal with all kinds of weird, creepy stuff that happens, it really is absolutely amazing. The Wehrmacht really comes to life, and you begin to really appreciate the Wehrmacht as an amazing machine. And these men that you see here, the photographs of these men, man, the things that they got up to and the things that they pulled off are some of the greatest feats of military history since Napoleon, since Frederick the Great, since Julius Caesar, I must tell you. The things they get up to are just astounding, what these white men are capable of. Truly, these Germans are just amazing. Anyhow, so let's take a look at Arart Raus. There's a story he tells, one of so many stories that he tells. And Raus tells this bizarre story of something that happens to a German battalion. The Russians are busy fighting. The Russians are busy attacking the Germans in the Ukraine. And the Russians are trying different tactics. So they attack a German battalion, one German battalion, in a certain way. And they surround them. And then they try a trick against another German battalion. And it's this second trick that we're going to focus on. Because what happens is so bizarre. What happens to these Germans is in many ways the same thing as what happens to whites with Jews. What the Russians do to the Germans is literally identical to what Jews do to white people. It's very much the same as what Jews do to us, even in a time of peace. And what is really fascinating about this battle is the tremendous confusion and chaos that is caused as a result of this bizarre thing. Again, I repeat, it's exactly the same as what happens to us in the 2020s, in modern times. It's exactly the same as what happens to us when Jews come among us. And the end result is total chaos. And it totally causes mayhem for the Germans. Now, one thing that you will find in history is that probably no history is studied in as much detail as military history. And nowadays, in army colleges around the world, they study all kinds of battles, military exercises, everything to do with warfare. They even study it going all the way back to Alexander the Great. Because even in this modern age with missiles and machine guns and aircraft and nuclear weapons, there are endless amounts of lessons that you can learn that a man who's going to be in a tank or is in charge of an anti-aircraft battery or a missile launcher, there are endless numbers of things that you can learn from military history. Even though the technology has changed, you can learn tons and tons of stuff. And right to this day, generals, academics, etc., study old history, ancient history. History that you would think is not relevant, but it is relevant and you can learn from it. And so what you're about to learn is about a battle. But in the same way, the stuff that happens in that battle has got a lesson. There's a lesson that we can learn for ourselves, for our own survival. So like I say, the Russians do to the Germans what the Jews do to all of us. And it results in total mayhem. But even worse is it happens under battle conditions. So it's mayhem, but it's mayhem where people are shooting at each other. And it's mayhem that can get you killed in the next few minutes. However, these Germans managed to get out of it. And the real lesson here is how they managed to get out of it. When they're in this chaos, confusion, mayhem, and people are being killed, there is a way that they solve their problem. And that is the key lesson, is how do they get out of their chaos? How do they get out of their mayhem? How do they actually survive? In fact, they go on to win. But you need to see what is the key ingredient that enables them to survive and win. So let's get on with the story, and when the story is over, I'll recap because there's a very critical lesson that comes out of this. And this critical lesson applies to us in the here and in the now. Let me read from Rouse's book. In a nutshell, what Rouse is describing is a Russian officer who tries to launch some attacks to break into the German lines. And he tries two different attacks. They are a couple of kilometers apart, but he tries different methods in the different places. He says that this is at the Donets River, which I assume is in Ukraine, because the Russians fought a lot in Ukraine in World War II. And what interests us is the second attack. So the Russians hit in the first place and they manage to surround some Germans and they do various things. But the Germans manage to eventually get reinforcements and manage to break out of the situation that they're in. But it's the second attack that is really interesting. So let me read it. The situation of the battalion adjacent on the south, however, was taking a rather critical turn. The northern flank of this battalion had been caught by the enemy push described above. It was able to oppose the enemy with only a weak, oblique defense line, which the Russians bypassed instead of pivoting heavy forces southward to expel the battalion from its dominating position on the hill. In this manner, the enemy hoped to be able to attack the valley position in the rear and thus bring about its collapse. The brave battalion, however, repulsed all the attacks of the superior enemy forces and continued to hold its tactically important bastion. So let me just pause there. What he's saying is that when the enemy attacked in the first attack, part of that attack also reached this second battalion. And despite this second battalion being tremendously outnumbered, they actually managed to hang on to their position on the hill. So everything seemed good, but then a most bizarre thing happened. Listen to this. All of a sudden, a completely unexpected event occurred. In a gap between the two battalions which were being attacked, soldiers in German uniforms and with German equipment appeared, and in good German reported the arrival of reinforcements which were to come to the aid of the harassed sector. This news was received with great joy and made its way through the position with lightning speed. Before it was possible, however, to ascertain the origin and strength of this unexpected help, the Russians attacked along the entire front of the battalion. The situation became extremely strained. The defenders were employed in the front line to the last man. At that moment, the soldiers of the newly arrived companies poured out of the woods in dense columns and opened a murderous hail of fire against the flank and rear of the defenders' forces. In the confusion that followed, there were shouts of, "Here are Germans, don't fire, cease fire, madness, what's going on here?" So let me just pause there. These new Germans appear between these two battalions, and they say that they are here to help the Germans. And then, suddenly, they attack the Germans. These new guys who supposedly are there to help them suddenly attack them from the side and from the rear. So now the Germans don't know what's going on. The Germans are being attacked by Germans. So let's continue. No one understood the other, and no one understood what was happening. The uncertainty and confusion had risen until everything was a hopeless mix-up. When, abruptly, the fire ceased and the pseudo-Germans attacked the German defenders with ear-splitting yells of "Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!" In this bewildering situation, desperate for the German battalion, in the forest, everyone now began to fight everyone else. It was impossible to tell friend from enemy. No one seemed to be able to help or disentangle the chaos. The battalion commander now understood the purpose of the insidious attack and was aware that the one decision possible was to reach the northern edge of a village in order to save his unit and prevent the valley position from being rolled up. He called for the men to gather in the village. This call had the effect of a kindling spark. The voice of the commander was recognized, and his order was passed on. Soon, every German soldier knew what to do. The will of the commander asserted itself. The order was not easy to execute, but unless it was carried out, every man and every piece of equipment was lost. The commander was firmly convinced that his officers and his seasoned infantrymen would make it. Quickly, he gathered up a few officers and all the soldiers in his immediate vicinity and formed an assault detachment from them, which he led personally, holding submachine guns and rifles in front of them ready to fire, or daggers and hand grenades in their clenched fists. They killed the Russians wherever they met them, recognizing them by their Mongolian features, whether they wore Russian or German uniforms. In this manner, the commander and his men made their way through the fighting soldiers and in short bounds reached the forest edge, from which some depressions and gullies led to the first houses of the village. Imitating this first party, everywhere soldiers banded together to form small detachments under the command of officers or non-commissioned officers and fought their way back to the village. Here, the commander immediately organized positions and incorporated in the defense of the village all newly arriving groups, as well as all soldiers of rear services who happened to be present in the village, regardless of the unit to which they belonged. The regimental headquarters, which had been informed immediately, rushed a company and a few assault guns, which had been transferred quickly by trucks from the division to the gravely distressed battalion. Favored by the terrain, which sloped toward the village and afforded cover from visibility and fire, the battalion, with the exception of some small elements, had assembled and prepared itself for defensive operations by late afternoon. When the enemy appeared on the edge of the forest soon thereafter, he was hit by machine gun fire and compelled to retire to the protection of the forest. Wherever he repeated his attempt to advance on the village, artillery and assault gunfire thwarted his intentions. Again and again he was forced to withdraw into the forest after sustaining serious losses. Gradually dark fell. So in the darkness, various other stragglers were also arriving back in the village, Germans who managed to escape from the forest. At night, the battalion had all but reached its full strength again. In view of the severe crises which it had gone through, its losses were very small. The battalion commander's presence of mind and the initiative of the non-commissioned officers saved the battalion from certain doom. The enemy's violation of international law, though resulting in the loss of an important bastion, failed to bring about the collapse of the front. What he's referring to is that the Russians have broken international law by wearing German uniforms and impersonating Germans, because these are, in military terminology, pseudo-Germans. They are speaking German, wearing German uniforms, and armed with German weaponry. And that's illegal, according to international law. And the British also did pseudo-operations in Kenya. So this kind of stuff was much more common after World War II, when we were facing black communists, and whites were the ones who were doing pseudo-stuff in order to stuff it up for the blacks. But in European and First World warfare, this is illegal. Another thing that's also illegal in international law in First World type of warfare is having partisans or troops fighting behind your lines. That is also illegal. And the Germans caught lots of them and shot them, which is totally legal by international law. So anyway, this trickery could have resulted in a really nasty situation, but by the evening, the Germans in that battalion had managed to gather back together. Their losses were very little because of the quick thinking of the battalion commander and the assistance of the non-commissioned officers. And they had formed small groups of guys bit by bit and got them out of the forest into the village, where they could now gather as a proper force. Meanwhile, the pseudo-Germans, the Russians impersonating the Germans, are in the forest. And their next goal is to try and attack the village and to take the village. So it had been a nightmare of a day for the Germans in two different attacks, one of which, as I've mentioned, we're not going to discuss, the one where the Germans were surrounded. But it's this one that really got nasty. So now it's in the evening, and the German commander of that battalion works through the night as he prepares for tomorrow's fight. So let's continue. The speed with which the battalion recovered from the blow which it had received at the end of the day is indicated by the fact that the commander was able that very night to plan to recapture the lost position on the following morning using the same unit which was still under the influence of the black day it had gone through. And he put his plan into effect at once. At dawn on 4 August, he hoped to hit the enemy, who was certain to try and advance further, so hard by means of a surprise blow that the lost hill position would be recaptured. The plan seemed very reasonable, and it was to be realized. As soon as there was enough light to permit firing, the enemy artillery and the heavy mortars began to shell the village, which was spread out in length. Soon the fire became very intense, with a deafening din echoed over and over again by the forest. The shells roared and whistled up to and burst in the village and on the other side of the road. Under the protection of this wall of fire, wave after wave of Russians broke out from the rim of the forest and ran down the slope of the Huttweide. I assume that is the name of the location. The leading elements had already come within storming distance when the German counterattack began. Ground attack and bomber wings, in other words Luftwaffe, appeared over the scene and attacked the enemy on a continuous basis. The assault guns, the number of which had been greatly increased during the night, moved forward against the enemy. All guns firing. These guns and the machine guns being fired from trenches, foxholes, and houses, as well as the artillery, anti-tank guns, and anti-aircraft artillery, spread such havoc in the ranks of the enemy's forces that their position on the terrain, which afforded no cover whatever, became untenable. Their only chance to escape the hail of fire was to withdraw to the forest. At the very moment, however, when the enemy first began withdrawing, the German artillery started firing a barrage on the edge of the forest. This inflicted severe losses on the enemy's forces, who were running in all directions, looking for a way to save themselves. Only battered remnants managed to find refuge in the forest. But even here, the enemy was given no time to assemble his troops and to use them in a renewed defensive effort, because the infantrymen, who were still smarting from the enemy's trickery on the previous day, followed the Russians, tracked them down in the forest, and, by pushing forward rapidly, prevented the enemy from gaining a firm footing again in the German hill position. Hardly 2 hours had passed since the beginning of the attack when the leading elements of the German infantrymen again reached the defense position they had occupied on the previous day. Soon afterward, the important bastion was back in German hands. The treacherous attack of the previous day had indeed brought about a rather critical situation, but his day's counterattack had nullified the enemy's unfairly gained success. Heavy losses in men and equipment were the result of this operation. Those who died that day included the majority of the Russians who had worn German uniforms. So it seems the German losses were not that much. It could have been a whole lot worse. It could have been a huge disaster. But instead, the Germans turned the tables on them, and it was the Germans who slaughtered most of the Russians who were in German uniforms. So let's recap. What was the key ingredient that caused the Germans to survive? Firstly, it was the commanding officer who realizes that these other Germans, these German reinforcements, are fake Germans, that they're not real Germans, that they are the enemy dressing up like Germans and pretending to be Germans. So the commander of the battalion realizes that these are fake Germans and he needs to get his guys together. And so when he calls out to them, the real Germans recognize him because they recognize the sound of his voice. But the key thing that the leader does is the leader gets together a bunch of the guys. He gets a small group together and they stick together. So the key thing is that a small group of the real Germans stick together and they move to the village. And little by little they get other real Germans together. But the point is that the thing that saves them is firstly the leader, and secondly, that they physically get together and they stick together and they bring more of their own together. And that really is the key to their survival. They are only able to function when they are together. And it doesn't matter how few of them there are, they just carry on and bring in more of their own people until eventually as many of the guys who have survived are now all together. They've managed to pull all the real Germans together in the village. And now it's easy. Now as a group they can fight these Mongolian types who are faking it as Germans. So the key thing is a leader and unity, regardless of how few of the real people there are. And from there onwards, as long as they just bring in the other people who are real Germans, from then onwards, they're on their way to winning. And it doesn't matter also what losses they took. And in their case, they didn't take that many losses, but clearly there were guys who were killed in the crossfire, etc. But the point is that regardless of the chaos alone was not enough. Even though they were shooting at each other, the chaos alone was not enough to destroy them. They actually survived. That, yes, it caused absolute mayhem. They went backwards. They lost their position on the hill. They had even shot each other. But at the end of the day, as long as they got their unity back, they could actually go back into the fight and they could win. And once they were together, regardless of their losses and regardless of the chaos that had taken place, once they were together and they could now make plans and the leader could call in for some assault guns and artillery to assist them, now they could go back and they could totally smash and slaughter those false Germans. And within a day, within 2 hours of the very next day, they were back on the top of that hill. They had not only killed all the fake Germans, but they'd even regained their original position that they'd lost. So when all was said and done, the chaos had caused mayhem, it had caused them to feel that they were going backwards, that everything had gone wrong. But once they got themselves together in a group, and they just stuck together as a group with their leader, it didn't matter the losses they'd taken, those who had died, the other things that they'd lost, like the retreat from their hill position. All those other losses were easily recoverable once they were back together as a team. And they even totally smashed and shot up and slaughtered the fake Germans. Once the leader understood who the enemy was and what the enemy was doing, he laid a trap for their fake enemy, their fake Germans. He knew they would come to attack them the next day. He waited for it, and he knew he would catch them out in the open, and when they want to run back, he already had the artillery ready, and the artillery went and pounded the crap out of them, and the next thing is they were fleeing for their lives. So they had used trickery to try to kill them the day before, but once the Germans, and especially the German leader, realized the nature of the trickery and what the real situation was, and he now had a chance to think it through, he could actually lay traps for them, and he destroyed them. He destroyed them almost completely. So that was a fantastic outcome. They'd been caught off guard through a hideous deception, but at the end of the day, once they understood what they were, who they were, etc., they could take that and play that game back on those same fake enemy scum, and they clobbered the living hell out of them. So, when you think about our position currently, and the chaos and the mayhem from, let's call it, the fake whites, and how they've caused trouble among us and caused confusion and mayhem, and we've not shot at each other, but we've attacked each other, we've been angry with each other, etc. And yet, as I've said to you, we can win. We can win everything back. Once you understand the deception that's taken place, and you now understand the trickery, you can go back and you can fight all our enemies. And I think that our situation is no different to those Germans. And yet those Germans were in a much, much more dangerous situation than we're in. Those Germans were in a much worse situation than we are. They had enemies right among them, shooting at them. They were shooting at each other. Our situation is nowhere even slightly anything as nasty as that. And I must tell you that I think, when all is said and done, that if we whites just stick together, if we just stick together, you'll see, all of us will be able to get everything back. Everything back. And our situation is not a fraction as nasty as what that battalion found itself in. So sit and ponder that. Don't worry about numbers. Don't worry about anything that's happening. Don't worry about the chaos. Just remember one thing. Stick together. find the real whites, stick together with the real whites, everything's going to be okay, and we're going to get everything back. Everything back. It's much easier than it seems.
So for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know, you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites. We gave you Breaking Bad and all the songs by Creed, all the cast of Friends and trash like Tara Reid, a virtual world of porn so you can spill your seed. Ray-Ban glasses, leggy blondes with tiny asses, frisbee sports and fancy coffee too, energy efficient lights. And so for all this awesome, neat, wonderful stuff, you know you don't thank the Lord, you thank the whites.
Thank the whites, you know you don't.